Tonight's talk is called Crossing the Flood. Sometimes the same talk could be also be called the simile of the raft on which this whole thing is based. And I thought I want to start just by reading to you this section from the Alagadapama Sutta, which is, this is just one section of a much longer sutta called the simile of the snake, interestingly enough, but this is a little piece that's embedded inside it that is an image that the Buddha uses in many other places, and I'll actually reference at least one other of them before we're finished. But I thought I'd just read the sutta first. It's called this. So, bhikkhus, I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful and whose further shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Then he thought, this is a great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bound them together into a raft. And supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? Here, bhikkhus, when the man got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it up onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, because it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with the raft. So this is a long image that has many parts to it. And so in this talk, what I want to do is very slowly take apart this image one step at a time and talk about it from the context of the Buddhist teachings. So first it starts off is that the shore this guy's on is dangerous. And what this, of course, is talking about is where we live in our daily lives. This shore that we live on is dangerous. And it isn't the world itself. This is good. Remember, this is all images. It isn't the actual world itself that is dangerous, though sometimes that's true too. But it's the habitual reactive patterns of our minds, our tendencies to greed, aversion, and delusion. And the safe shore, the shore the guy wants to get to, is where we have learned equanimity, where we've learned not to be reactive to the contents of the mind. So this is like the right understanding, the first step on the Eightfold Path, essentially. And I suspect that if you're like me, in the last few days, your mind has been pretty reactive. And this body of water, which in other places and other suttas, and sometimes in the translations of this particular sutta, is called the flood. Hence the name crossing the flood, which is a pretty good description of what goes on in our mind sometimes. You know, that mental formations just flow one after another, after another, after another. I'm worried, I'm afraid, I'm angry, da 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 da. It just goes on and on and on and on. It never stops. It's a flood. And normally what happens is we just react to the flood. This happens and we react this way, and that's not, we tend to be reactive. Unless we're very mindful, that's what happens. Something arises. If it's pleasant, we go one way. If it's unpleasant, we go another way. Where we fall into our habitual patterns of reaction. The flood sweeps us away yet again. And this flood has several pieces to it. And I came across this really interesting book by someone named Ajahn Susito. And he talks about the four aspects of the flood. And I thought it'd be useful to look at this so we really understand what I'm talking about when I say the flood, right? So the first of these is the flood, what he calls the flood of sensuality. You know, sense experiences that we label pleasant or unpleasant, and we go after more or try to avoid. That's the cycle we go through. And this is what Ajahn Susito had to say about this, which I think is quite good. With some experience and considered attention, we can note that none of these, once seen, heard, etc., actually induce the kind of feeling that the current promises in any but the most fleeting way. In the gentle or pulsing waves of this flood, however, the objects of the senses seem irresistible. Notice the word, the gentle and pulsing. I mean, sometimes the flood is not that floody. It's like, it's just like, just going along. It seems, everything seems to be going pretty good. It seems to seem charming and productive of real satisfaction. And yet the manifest truth of our lives is that we are not blissed out or even satisfied for long by any sense contact. It happens all day long. And with luck, it's mostly okay. Sometimes it's pleasant for a short while, and sometimes it's unpleasant. But the pleasant, once established, gets to be normal and then boring. So the desire for new sources of pleasure kick in. However, we can't really have any of it because it runs through consciousness like water through our fists. Sensory input with its pleasures and displeasure passes. So that flood just keeps passing by. And though at times it seems, ooh, I like that, you know, some nice dinner or some interesting movie on TV or who knows what, there's some pleasantness. And I'm not denying the pleasantness of those things. But they all pass because of everything's impermanent. Everything is always changing. And things go by and they're gone. So that's the flood, what he calls the flood of sensuality. Then the second one he identifies is the flood of becoming. The ideas that center around time and identity, thought of past and future, are actually happening right now. That's a really interesting idea, that we have thoughts about the past and we have thoughts about the future. But actually, all that's happening is we're having thoughts about the past and the future right now. That's what's actually, if you look at what's actually happening, that's all that's happening. Once again, Ajahn Susito. And yet there's a current in the mind that creates a felt identity, who was, is, and will be. Rolling on its surface are worries and expectations about what I will be, nostalgia and regret about what I was, A conceit may form, having been this, surely I deserve to become that. Or its negative form, I've never been this, so I'll never become one of those. There's a lot of drama and suffering and stress in this flood, so much so that we fail to question, who is this character? The spell of the flood of becoming doesn't work in the present. That is why we study it, because through investigation, we come out of it. If we're just in the present moment all the time, the flood of becoming isn't there. Because it's all based on thoughts of the past and thoughts of the future, which is most of our thoughts. Most of the stories we tell ourselves are either about something that happened or about something we want to happen or is going to happen or we're worried it's going to happen. And that's the power of being in the present moment, is that all that goes away. That flood is just turned off. And then there's something, what he calls the flood of views, which is an extension, I think, of the flood of becoming. You know, deep-rooted ideas of who we are and how things are. You know, I've talked about this before, but it's like, it's so easy to get caught up in believing that this is how things are. I know I'm right and they're wrong. And then based on that belief, speaking or acting in unskillful ways and causing suffering for ourselves and for others. It's so easy. And the problem with this part of the flood, it's hard to see. It's hard to see that I have this deep-seated view that arose out of how I was brought up or the church I went to once upon a time when I was younger, or you know, what our culture teaches us, or something I read yesterday that somehow, that makes sense. Now that becomes a view. And then I start to speak and act from that place. But they're just views. They're just thoughts in the mind that are at a deeper level, often almost unconscious, unless we start to really pay attention to them. And then the final piece of the flood from Ajahn Sahita's point of view was what he called the flood of ignorance. This is the underground current that is made up of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. If we don't see that, if we don't see that that's the basis of everything, then we get caught up in this flood of ignorance, of not understanding that everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. And this layer of the flood supports all the other layers. It's what, you know, lies underneath. That's why when I talk a lot about meditative practice, at a certain point, the top three layers are like the content of the mind, the stuff, the stories. And then beneath that is this current of ignorance, of not understanding. And the practice gradually takes us to a place where we start to see that underlying current and are not so fascinated by the details, the content. That's just stuff. We start to see it's just that. And we start to see instead these underlying patterns. Okay. So then the question arises. Why don't we do something about crossing this flood? If we all, because I've seen you all like nodding, going, yeah. we all know this is true. What is it that stops us from actually crossing the flood? And it's another subtle layer of the flood in some sense. It's that identity we have that self-identity that said something along the lines of, oh, I'm not ready yet. Or I need to be better. Or I'll do that when I have more time. You know, we come up with this constant layer of excuses about why we're not trying to cross the flood. And it's not that we think, oh, well, once I make the decision to cross the flood, then everything's hunky-dory. Now the hard part's going to start. We also understand that. And we go, oh, I don't know. Why should I get into that? You know, why do I want to go there? You know, I got enough to do with that. But it's like, this is the second step in the Eightfold Path, right intention. It's like we have to actually form the intention to do what we can to cross the flood. Otherwise, we're just going to sit here on this dangerous shore forever. We're never going to get to the other shore. If we don't have intention, nothing's going to happen. Everything arises from intention. Without intention, no action ever happens. So, here we are on the edge of this great expanse of water, as it says in the sutta, and there's no ferry, and there's no bridge. There's no easy way to get across. A ferry's like, well, someone else will take me across. Right? Or a bridge, well, someone else has gone across and made this nice bridge, and all I got to do is walk across it. Sorry, neither of those exist. There's no easy, simple way to get across. That's what he's talking about here. So instead, what he does in the sutta is he makes a raft. He said, okay, I'll just make a raft. I mean, this was like 2,500 years ago. It was a pretty normal thing to do to get across a river, probably was to make a raft. But he makes the raft. He says, and then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bound them together into a raft. Doesn't sound like much of a raft, does it? It's just like a bunch of twigs and leaves all tied together. This is like, I don't know if I want to use that. I'm not so sure I like that raft. You know, and so we think, okay, if I'm going to build a raft, I better build a really big raft out of solid logs. I'm going to put a sail on it and a mast, and I got to have room on the raft for all my stuff. Yeah, you know, it's like that's what we have another excuse for not going across, because I'm busy building this big, safe, efficient, modern raft, and we never actually launch the raft because we're so busy building it all the time. We never actually get out onto the water. And what the Buddha is saying with this image is that we don't need anything. We just take whatever is around us right now. In this case, you know, in the image, leaves and grass and twigs and a few branches and lash them together. Doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to go anyplace. You don't have to, you know, take a course on how to build a good raft. You just build it out of what's right there around you right now. Nothing special is required. You know, you got a raft. You don't have to make any sort of big preparations. You don't have to make any special thing. You just take what you already have, and that's sufficient to create this raft. What you know right now, the practice you have right now, is sufficient. It's enough. Don't need anything else. Oops, there's another excuse gone for not going across, right? And part of this is we have to start, our Western mind wants to sort of plan everything out and figure everything out and make sure everything's we're in completely in control before we even start. And we have to give up that idea and just go, okay, I'm going to go out there and get wet, get on this raft and get out there and start crossing the flood. That's what I'm just going to do it. That's right intention. And the problem is, of course, that with this somewhat flimsy raft, we're bound to get wet. It's not going to be really pleasant. We're not going to sort of sail across on this luxury raft. We're going to have to get out there, you know, and use our arms and our feet. We have to, right effort. There we go. There's right effort. I got to use my arms and my feet. I have to apply effort. And it's going to be kind of splashy. I'm going to get wet for sure. I want to read a little poem here. This is by Dana Faulds from her book, Go In and In. It's called Awakening. Can I withstand the radiance? When the goddess gazes from my eyes, when my heart opens wide, when the current of life sweeps me away from safety, when even the illusion of control is lost and what's left to me is love, can I breathe a prayer of gratitude and praise? Unlike the winter groundhog, can I raise my face to the sun and not run from the shadow that, embodied, I will always cast in daylight? That's what we have to do. We have to accept the shadow side too. I can't be perfect before I start, because it's the process of going across that leads towards perfection. The shadow side is going to be there. It's going to be unpleasant. All that stuff is going to come up. That flow of stuff in the mind isn't all, you know, roses and jelly beans. You know, it's going to be stuff that isn't so pleasant. I don't know. Where did roses and jelly beans come? I don't know. Just a little thought popped into my brain. But basically, we have to directly experience the contents of the mind, which is what crossing the flood. If you're on this flimsy raft splashing around in the water, you're going to experience the flood for sure, all of it. Whatever's in there, you're going to experience it. You know, it's just, that's the way it is. So, in another sutta, this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And the first section of the Samyutta Nikaya, which Samyutta basically means collected, they've collected all of the discourses where the Buddha meets some deva or Brahma, some celestial being comes down and comes down for instruction, because they realize that they're stuck up in this glorious heaven where they are. They're not getting any instruction and they need to come down to deal with this earth guy on the earth to get instruction from the Buddha. So this is the style of these. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's grove. Then when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jetta's grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" The Buddha replies, "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." So this is a pretty good description of what's often called the middle way that the Buddha talked about over and over and over again. It's like this sort of balanced approach of right action and skillful effort. If we strain, if we try too hard, we make practice into this sort of grim duty. You know, I have to do this, yes, sir. And when we do that, we get swept away, because if we're not at some level feeling joy from the practice, at least sometimes, then it's just going to become this grim thing, and we go, ugh. We get swept away by it. Because we become exhausted and discouraged. If it's always just grim duty, this practice becomes very exhausting. Having been on long, grim retreats where I got caught in this sort of space, it's just like, I ended up just being totally bagged by just doing the practice. I mean, all I have to do is sit and walk all day long. How can that be tiring, right? But it was like exhausting to be caught in that space. And when we strain, we get even wetter. Like we're straining, we're splashing around a lot more. And we just become overwhelmed by our thoughts and emotions. So we can't strain. And if we halt, we sink. We get swallowed up by this constant stream. If we stop practicing, then we just fall back into those old reactive patterns that are still there. So we can't stop. We can't halt, because then we just sink into that stream of stuff that's constantly flowing through our minds without ever ending. It's endless. We lose the strength, and we lose whatever practice we've gained. Whatever strength we've got from that practice, we lose that too, or we lose some of it. And we have to start all over again. Oh, well, I'll make another raft. And you know. This is why daily practice is so important. This is why daily practice, because then we never stop. It creates this continuous motion across the flood. And this sinking often arises when our mind goes to a place where, that's enough. Things are good. Things are fine. I'm okay. I can chill for a while now. And that just, there we are, caught in the flood again. There's another understanding of this image too, which I think is also a possible way to look at it. We halt sometimes when the practice becomes very pleasurable, very sweet. We get caught by that sweet, pleasurable practice. And, oh, this is great. I'm just going to hang out here. That's where it's so easy to get caught in that space of just, here I am in this nice, calm, still space again. I'll just hang out here. So easy to go there and just get caught in it. And we strain when we are caught in adverse and unpleasant things arising one after another. Oh, I got to get out of this. I can't hang out here. This is really horrible. As opposed to just going, oh, this is what I got now. This is what's arising. And being able to go, and that's okay. It's not pleasant, and that's okay. Instead, we struggle to somehow, no, I'm gonna get out of this. And I'm not saying that sometimes it's not skillful to when something, a repetitive, unpleasant story keeps arising over and over again, that sometimes it's quite skillful to sort of go, oh, I paid attention to this. I know this story. I've been here. I've done that. I don't need to hang out with this anymore. Then it's sometimes quite skillful to, you know, switch to some other, like switch to meta for self or some, there's some other way. Okay. Here's another thing that stops us. That's fear of failure. Fear that I can't do this. And that fear of failure stops us from even making the attempt. That fear of failure stops us from getting wet at all. No, that's just too scary. And here's an interesting thing about this sutta I just read. I'm going to read this line again. When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. This is the Buddha talking. This is the Buddha saying, I failed several times. Oh, wait. It's okay to fail. It's not like the end of the world. You struggle. Sometimes you're going to get caught by the current and swept away. Sometimes you're going to get complacent and sink. And then you just start again and again and again. It's okay. So don't let fear of failure stop you at all. The Buddha failed several times, according to what he just said here. So if it's good enough for the Buddha, it seems like it's probably okay for me to fail too. To struggle and sink and struggle and flail around and then start again. I find that particular line in the sutta very heartening. Oh, the Buddha failed. Oh, okay. That sort of takes the pressure off in some sense. It's like, oh, I don't have to worry quite so much about being perfect anymore. Then, actually, I wanted to read this idea, this sense of, quote, failing. First of all, even if you fail, you've probably learned something useful. And that thing that you've learned will make the next attempt better, easier, because you've got that you've learned something along the way. So even to the point of saying, well, what's really, was that really a failure, or was that just like a cycle of the learning experience? You know, we can play with semantics and words here. But it's like, oh, yeah, hopefully I actually learned something useful. You know, I learned that when I flail around in that particular way, when I try that particular stroke with my arms and legs, it didn't work. It got too much. I was driving too hard. Okay, I have to learn to be a little more mellow about this, but at the same time, keep going. For instance, this idea of that we can repeatedly start again is a common theme in the Buddhist teachings as well. And I came across this wonderful book, this is several years ago, called Early Buddhist Women. And this is a series of stories that have been researched about the early female disciples of the Buddha. which is quite a wonderful book. Since all three of you are women, you might find this useful. So I want to recommend it on that level. This is often because this is a very male teaching in some senses. You know, it's the Buddha and his disciples are always usually guys. But there were many women who were also disciples of the Buddha, and he was actually quite radical. I mean, 2,500 years ago in his day, if you were born a woman, basically the story was, well, better luck next lifetime. Maybe you'll be lucky and be born a man. Otherwise, just, you know, go take care of the goats and the kids, you know. That was sort of the vibe for being a woman in his day. And he said, no, no, no. Women were perfectly capable of doing this. And he encouraged women to take vows and form a separate order of bhikkhunis specifically for women who wanted to practice, who had the same strictures placed on their life as the male bhikkhus. And the interesting, this was all leading to this poem. And one of the things the nuns did, which I found quite interesting, and this book pointed out, is they, when they reached enlightenment, they wrote a poem about that experience. Kind of nice, I think. That sort of expressed the most important aspect of the experience that led to their enlightenment. And this is called Uttama's story. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. Failing over and over, right? I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged, 7 days full of joy. When on the 8th I stretched out my feet, the great dark was torn apart. This is an enlightenment story. She kept trying, then she heard the Dharma in the right way. She practiced intensely in 7 days. It's a lot. But when on the 8th I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. She failed. She tried again. She reached enlightenment. That's the nature of this practice in some senses. So then, in this sutta, another interesting thing happens in this sutta, where the Buddha says, then he says, basically, when you get to the other shore, don't cling to the raft. Huh? Like the raft is like the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the raft, right? When you get to the other shore, you don't need the raft anymore. Don't cling to it and carry it around with you. You're not going to need it anymore. Oh, so the Dhamma, as amazing as the Dhamma is, amazing as the teachings are, they're just skillful means to help us get across to the other side. That's what the Dhamma is. The Dhamma is the raft that gets us across to the other side. Then we don't need the Dhamma. We don't need the teachings anymore. We're on the other side. That's what the Buddha is saying here, which I think is quite astonishing when you think about it. But that's the whole point of this teaching, is that even the Dhamma is not something to cling to. If we cling to it, then we're stuck at that point in our practice. We can't cling to it. But, of course there's a but here, right? How do we know that we're on the other shore? How do I know it's time to let go of the raft? You know, if I let go too soon, there I am, swept away with the current again. How do I know that now it's time to let go of the raft? Read another piece of sutta here. This is once again from the Samyutta Nikaya. When bhikkhus, a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice, looks at the handle of his adze, he sees the impressions of his fingers and his thumb, but he does not know so much of the adze handle was worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it is worn away, the knowledge occurs to him that it is worn away. Basically, what the Buddha is saying here is, when you're enlightened, you'll know. But it's a very gradual process. I mean, think about the amount of time it would take to wear away the handle of an adze. Well, just by using it. I mean, little tiny, tiny bits keep coming off over years and years and years and years. But that's the nature of enlightenment. It's like, it's that sort of gradual, slow process. I want to read something else here. This is a really interesting sutta where a group of bhikkhus has come to the Buddha and declared that they have become enlightened. And one of the people there, one of the bhikkhus there, observing this, goes, how do we know? How do we know if they're enlightened? How do they know if they're enlightened? And Buddhaji, do you know if they're enlightened? And the Buddha gives quite a detailed explanation here. He says, I've heard, Venerable Sir, that a number of bhikkhus have declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One. Did they do so rightly, or are there some bhikkhus here who declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves? Buddha answers, when some bhikkhus declared final knowledge in my presence, there were some bhikkhus who declared final knowledge rightly, and there were some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves. Therein, when bhikkhus declare final knowledge rightly, the declaration is true. But when bhikkhus declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, the Tathagata thinks, I should teach them the Dhamma. Oh, wait, I got to teach them some more. Got to pay more attention. And then he goes on where one of the stages, and now the Buddha starts talking about the stages of concentration, the stages that people go through as they move towards enlightenment in deeper and deeper layers of concentration. And one of them he says, is it possible that some person here may be intent on the imperturbable, which is one of these stages of concentration? When a person is intent on the imperturbable, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about worldly material things is going on, he will not listen to it and give it ear or exert his mind to understand it. He does not associate with that kind of person, and he does not find satisfaction there. Just as a yellow leaf that has fallen from its stalk is incapable of becoming green again, so when a person is intent on the imperturbable, he has shed the fetter of worldly material things. He should be understood as a person detached from the fetter of worldly material things who is intent on the imperturbable. And then the Buddha says, but this person still isn't enlightened, even having shed the fetters of material things, this, which means basically it no longer has desire for any material objects, has gone beyond that craving for things. And it goes on and it says, it is possible that some person here may be completely intent on nibbana. When a person is completely intent on nibbana, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about the base of neither perception nor non-perception is going on, he will not listen to it. This is another layer of the layers of concentration. Or give it ear or exert his mind to understand it. He does not associate with that kind of person. Just as the palm tree with its top cut off is incapable of growing again. So if you chop off a palm tree, it doesn't sprout up from the roots like, say, an oak tree or something would. Just as the palm tree, when its top cut off, is incapable of growing again, so too, when a person is completely intent on nibbana, his fetter of the base of neither perception nor non-perception has been cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with, so that is no longer subject to future arising. He should be understood as a person detached from the fetter, which is basically a way of describing someone who's enlightened. The interesting thing about this whole sutta, because there were several more sub-steps and things, I didn't go into all the details, is that the Buddha is saying, this happens, this is a slow, step-by-step process. This isn't something like turning on a light switch. It happens over time, and we are always having, and I've said this before, we're having these little moments of enlightenment all the time, and gradually, these moments of enlightenment become more frequent, and we have more of them, and it gets more of them, and less of the other, and like closer and closer together, until all we're having is moments of enlightenment. That's my understanding. I'm not speaking from experience here. It's my understanding of what the Buddha's teachings say quite clearly. So that, I guess what I'm saying is we shouldn't get discouraged. Oh, I'm not enlightened yet. What's wrong with me? It's like it's a slow, steady, imperceptible sometimes, like the handle of the adze slowly wearing away. And that's what this practice does. It wears away our habitual patterns of mind that we get swept away by over and over. Gradually, things that used to sweep us away don't sweep us away anymore. You know, the flood loses its power over time as we practice more. And the things that, parts of the flood that used to be like, oh my God, that. This is like, oh, you just see, oh, there's another, you know, impermanent non-self phenomena passing by. It doesn't catch us anymore. We're not swept away by it anymore. And more of that happens. So, having said all that, I guess the only thing I want to do is encourage you to get wet. Get in there and start splashing around. I know you probably are all ready splashing around, but just don't get discouraged by how wet you're getting. It's just, that's the nature of this. You're going to get wet. It's messy. It's uncomfortable. But that's the nature of the practice. It isn't all sweetness and light. It's hard. So let me finish with this, another poem by Dana Faulds. It's called life here at the edge. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there is danger in not staying safely cloaked in morality and labels, but there's life here at the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities, then move and call you to come forth in freedom and fullness. Trust the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. Nothing like a little poetry at the end of the day. So that's so let's just dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Barry. Good night. Good night, everyone.
Good night.